Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Gertrude the Great. Pope Benedict focuses his general audience catechesis on the figure of St. Gertrude, the 13th century nun who was noted for her writings and life of intense prayer. Women within the Church. The Centenary Assembly of the World Union of Catholic Women's Organizations is currently underway in Jerusalem, and we find out more about what's on their agenda. Holy Land Exodus. One of the key issues on the agenda at this month's Synod of Bishops for the Middle East is the plight of the dwindling Christian community in the region, and we find out why Christians are leaving the land of Jesus' birth. And Nobel Prize Ethics. A leading Catholic bioethics centre criticises this week's awarding of the Nobel Prize for Medicine to the British pioneer of in vitro fertilisation treatment. The Vatican, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of the 13th century nun and writer St. Gertrude the Great as he continued his series of reflections on women of the medieval church. Lydia Kane reports.
Pope Benedict arrived into an autumnal but sunny St. Peter's Square on Wednesday to be greeted by thousands of pilgrims and tourists. As has become customary at his weekly general audience, the Holy Father focused his catechesis on Wednesday on great women of the early church, recalling the figure of St. Gertrude the Great.
St. Gertrude is the only woman in Germany destined to be called great, an honour due to her exceptional natural and supernatural gifts. As a youth, Gertrude was intelligent, strong, and decisive, but also impulsive. With humility, she asked others for advice and prayer. Eventually, she experienced a deep conversion. In her studies, she passed from worldly pursuits to sacred sciences. And in her monastic observance, she moved from concern with external things to a life of intense prayer.
The Pope then went on to talk about this saint's written works, which drew on spiritual themes.
In her writings, she sought to explain the truths of the faith with clarity and simplicity, while not failing to develop spiritual themes associated with divine love. In her religious practice, she pursued prayer with devotion and faithful abandonment to God. Dear friends, may we learn from St. Gertrude the Great how to love Christ and his church with humility and faith, and to cultivate our personal prayer through an intense participation in the Holy Mass and the sacred liturgy.
Towards the end of his audience, the Holy Father welcomed all the English visitors and pilgrims, and he especially extended his greetings to the candidates for diaconate ordination from the Pontifical North American College. One of those candidates listening to the Pope's words was seminarian Jim Barron from Colorado Springs in the U.S.
It's a tremendous opportunity to be with the Holy Father today, especially with all of my parents, friends and family, with my bishop, as a real sign of the importance of the family in the church and how we all turn to our Holy Father and with him in prayer for vocations and for future ministry to families and to all of our friends in the church and even outside the church.
The Pope also had greetings for the new students and staff at the Pontifical Beda College and to pilgrims from Dublin in Ireland. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Staying on the subject of women within the Church, the Centenary Assembly of the World Union of Catholic Women's Organizations is being held this week at the Pontifical Institute of Notre Dame in Jerusalem. The theme of the assembly is You Will Be My Witness. Tracy McClure filed this report from Jerusalem.
The World Union is comprised of almost 100 Catholic women's organizations representing more than 5 million women, active in more than 60 countries across the globe. Each is recognized by its National Episcopal Conference. The Pontifical Council for the Laity has erected Wukwo as a public international association of the faithful. Speakers during the days of the conference will be addressing themes of marriage and family life and Christian anthropology in a culturally changing, globalized world. They'll also be hearing from speakers about their experiences in education and spirituality. Speakers will be providing spiritual formation and education, which will be motivating 500 delegates from throughout the world here to be faithful witnesses of Jesus. The realities of life here on the ground will be presented by a panel of local Christian women: Claudette Habesh, director of Caritas Jerusalem; Hanadi Suda Yunan, professor at Bethlehem University; and Sister Maria Grech, the director of the Franciscan Family Center in Bethlehem, are just some of the local speakers who will be attending. A panel of Focolare Youth interfaith representatives will also be present, sharing how they strive to build peace for everyone. Participants will be attending Sunday Mass in various Latin and Melkite parishes in order to meet the living stones, the Christians of the Holy Land. And of course, delegates of member organizations will be adopting resolutions, electing a new leadership, and they'll be working to reinforce the fruits of Wukwo partner organizations across the globe. In Jerusalem, I'm Tracy McClure.
Hurley is president of the World Union of Catholic Women's Organizations, or WCWO, and she spoke to Tracy about the key issues they are discussing at this assembly.
Well, the objectives are to celebrate, first and foremost, 100 years of service by women, for the church and society. And so it's appropriate that we've come to Jerusalem, to the Holy Land, to the roots of our faith, the land where Jesus walked, so that we can encounter him in a very special way. We are bringing together more than 500 women from more than 50 countries around the world who represent more than 5 million Catholic women who are active in more than 60 countries. And we find this as a way of witnessing our faith, of celebrating who we are and what we do as Catholic women.
And what are some of the activities that these women's organizations all over the world are actually doing, they're involved in?
The women around the world are doing work primarily in the areas of respect for life, whether it be for the unborn, protecting the sanctity of life from natural conception to natural death, whether it be for the aging, those who may be suffering from AIDS or other illnesses. A lot of the women are working as advocates, advocating for God's moral law within their governments and within the international fora, the United Nations. They're trying to protect the environment, whether through the ecological environment or whether through safe environments for children in their schools and in their churches.
Why was Wukwo established 100 years ago? What were the aims of creating an organization like that?
In 1910, Catholic women came together from different countries, from France, Germany, England, primarily European organizations, as well as those from Brazil and Uruguay, and they dreamed of having an international union of Catholic women's leagues, and that's truly what they called the organization to begin with. And their statutes declared that an international council was formed between these national Catholic women's leagues. It would be independent of all political parties, and the aim of the council was to work to maintain faith, to defend religious liberties, and to organize Catholic social action in a spirit of full and constant submission to the ordinances of the Supreme Pontiff. And throughout the years, that's what the members of the International Union did. In 1952, the name of the organization changed to the World Union of Catholic Women's Organizations, which is now known by the acronym WUCWO or WUCWO. And we continue to promote the presence, participation, and co-responsibility of Catholic women in church and society in order to enable them to fulfill their mission of evangelization and to work for human development.
That was Karen Hurley, president of the World Union of Catholic Women's Organizations, or WCWO. This Sunday sees the start of the two-week Synod of Bishops for the Middle East taking place here in the Vatican. The Synod's main theme focuses on communion and witness, and participants will be studying how all the various rites can strengthen their communion and unity, and so offer that effective witness in a region where the Church is often a fragile minority among Muslims or Jews. Regional church leaders view the Synod as an important opportunity to call attention to the various problems facing Christians in the area. One of the most serious problems causing widespread concern within the Church is the continuing emigration of Christian families from the Holy Land. Some fear that if this exodus is not halted, there is a risk of not having a viable living Christian presence in the land of Jesus' birth within a few generations. Father Peter Vasco is the director of the Franciscan Foundation for the Holy Land that was formed to help safeguard the continued presence of the Christian minority living in the Holy Land, especially by offering funding for education. He spoke to me about some of the main reasons why life is so difficult for this dwindling Christian community in Jesus' birthplace.
Well, this synod will be discussing the vulnerability of about 9 to 10 million displaced Christians. And I think basically when you're speaking about the vulnerability of Christians in the Holy Land, it really is the lack of freedom of movement. Closures and checkpoints dominate the countryside. And I think this is one of the main reasons why there is so much unrest in the Holy Land for all the Palestinians, whether they be Christians and or Muslims. I think Israel looks at the Christians, at least the Israeli government and Israeli defense forces, they look at the Christians, Palestinian Christians, as Arabs and hence the enemy, while the militant Muslims look upon the Palestinian Christians as pro-West and traitors to the Islamic cause. So they are sort of caught in the middle. They are the ones who are suffering, and they are the ones who are leaving because of these political as well as economic factors.
Okay, turning to the political factors and the military factors, and you said it's got much more difficult with the security wall and everything. Now, how optimistic are people there in the Holy Land that the new round of talks between Palestinians and Israelis will lead somewhere? We've seen so many rounds of peace talks in the past that went nowhere.
Well, that is the point where most people are very concerned. I don't see great progress in the peace talks. There's been, as you said, so many different agreements, so many different accords. None of them have ever been adhered to. And so in the long run, I believe people are getting very discouraged. They're seeing that nothing is happening. And all we're seeing is political posturing on the part of the various parties. So there is sort of a dismal negative feeling that a political solution will ever be resolved. I don't think it will.
Now, this synod is discussing the various problems and issues facing the church and Christians in the Middle East. What are the most serious in your view? Is it, in fact, that continuing emigration of Christians to other parts of the world?
Oh, I think it is. And I think that the problem is if you're dealing with countries who, for example, where there's civil war, and unrest among Christians like it was way back when a dozen years ago in the Lebanese War, when you're speaking about persecution, real persecution of the Christians, for example, in Egypt, you have this constant exodus. But when you're speaking about the situation in the Holy Land, in Israel / Palestine, I think basically you're speaking about discrimination both in jobs and housing And this is one of the main reasons why, at least in the Holy Land, our Christians are leaving. But there are different reasons why the Christians are so vulnerable. Religious intolerance in Iraq has caused a lot of the Christians to leave. So each country in the Middle East has had its reasons why these 9 to 10 million people have been displaced.
Right. Turning to the Holy Land, do you believe, as some do, that a living and resident Christian community in the land of Jesus' birth risks becoming extinct within a couple of generations if emigration continues at its present pace?
Well, I believe that through the Franciscan Foundation, we have seen a change. I had an audience with the Holy Father, and he was briefed about the work of the Franciscan Foundation in the Holy Land. And he said to me, he says, Father Peter, higher education is the key to keeping our Christians there in the Holy Land. And that is what the foundation has been doing for the last 12 years. We have been giving college education to economically marginalized students who have great academic acumen. And we are seeing now that 70% of those who are graduating are now staying because they have become professional people, whether that be in medicine, in law, in engineering, in business, in education. And these were the students, young people who were going to leave for South America, for Canada, for the United States, and now we see that they are staying. And this is the secret of keeping our Christians in the Holy Land, at least from our standpoint and the work we've been doing for the last 12 years. There will always be a certain percentage of Christians who will be leaving because why? They have families in those other countries. But we're focusing in on the marginalized Christians who don't have, for example, those opportunities. And we're giving them those opportunities through education so they can have hope for the future. So these people, young people, are now staying. Now, it's just a small dent. We're only talking about 160 young people who have been given or are taking university scholarships in Israel as far as Amman and Cairo. But these young people are finally staying in the Holy Land. So education, higher education, is the key. Because through an education, they can get a job, and through a job, they can afford housing. And that is the three-pronged approach that really affects our people. It's education, it's jobs, and housing. And we see now a light at the end of a very, very dark tunnel.
You talked about making a small dent in this continuing exodus of Christians. How many Christians, do we have any idea how many Christians are leaving each year from the Holy Land?
That study has not been made. About 10 years ago, there were 500 families leaving every year from Bethlehem. But I do not have any updated information of exactly how many are leaving. All I know is that our program has been started, has begun, and it's something that's going to go on for many years to come. And those are the people, although it's a small dent, that is where it's going to change. But it's going to take a long time. So we have to be very optimistic. It's a slow process, but higher education is the key for our young people to remain in the Holy Land.
And how would you describe in general the mood of the Christian community in the Holy Land when you go about and meet people? What do they say? What are the chief problems they're facing in their daily lives? Is it, as you say, the lack of freedom of movement, the security barrier?
I think both of those points, the lack of freedom of movement, the barrier, has had a negative effect in a certain sense upon their personality, upon their thinking about their future. But, you know, the Christians, if you think about it, have suffered a long time in the Middle East, starting from the first century. So they're used to, in a certain extent, to the difficulties. They're accepting the difficulties, but they're going on instead. They're not going to dwell on it, but certainly the practical problems of movement, of closures, and this and that has certainly caused negativity and disappointment, obviously, among them. But most of the Christians in the Holy Land are doing what they can do. It's not the ideal situation, but they're bearing with it.
The Synod Fathers are also likely to be discussing the dangers of what has been termed a ghetto mentality among Christians in the Middle East. Do you see many examples of that in the area where you live and work in the Holy Land?
Well, would say, I mean, obviously, you have to understand in Israel, you have East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. None of the Arabs, Palestinian people, Christian or Muslims, live in West Jerusalem. They probably wouldn't maybe even define an apartment in West Jerusalem because the Israelis would not even sell to a Palestinian. And then you have on the East Jerusalem, for example, where most of the Arabs live, both Palestinians, Muslims, and Christians. And then, for example, the pockets of Christianity obviously are in Bethlehem, although they only represent now 30% of the population, when about 40 years ago it was 70% of the population. You have the little hamlets of Beth-Sahur and Beth-Jala, which are basically Christian. So there are pockets. But remember, we're only 150,000 out of almost 9 million people, including the West Bank and Gaza, as well as Israel proper. So we're a very small minority. We've always been a minority within a minority, whether it's been on the Ottoman Turks or under the Israeli rule. So we stay in little pockets. Yes, there is sort of a ghetto mentality, it's a siege mentality, because, you know, as we explained, the militant Muslims look at them as pro-West and traitors to the Islamic cause. So they're living among them, they feel that, and you do stay with each other, you stay with your own kind. They do have Muslim friends, obviously, but it's not something that is a big and long-term relationship. But yes, there is a bit of that only because of the circumstances.
What about the rise of political Islam? This is one of the key issues being discussed at the Synod of Bishops. What are the reasons for this rise, and how much of a threat is it to the Christian minority?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, I believe the problem began in 1947 when the UN, they partitioned Palestine. That is when people started to get, the Arabs began to really unite with each other and against this new state of Israel. And then it eventually led, of course, as we know, to the 1967 Six-Day War, and thus led to the occupation of the territories by Israel. And from this time on, this has caused this rise of Arab nationalism. You know, ownership of the land has always been the ultimate crux of the entire problem that everyone reads about in the Holy Land, both claiming the same land. And this has been a major factor in the rise of Arab nationalism since 1947.
So to sum up, what do you hope will come out of this synod? What message would you like to hear at the end of it?
Well, you know, when you speak about what would you like at the end of this synod to, well, what's the message they would want to give, I think the church has to give encouragement principally to our people to let them know that there is a future, that they have to be patient, that they have to be long-suffering, because there's no real political solution to this problem. I think they have to give, the synod has to give our people more hope, more encouragement that there is a future. From that, hopefully, people will be able to accept the present situation, sufferings that they're going through now, but with the hope that new realities will be coming into the future for them as a Christian community in the various countries. Obviously, some countries will never have that, be given that hope because of persecution, but others will.
I was speaking to Father Peter Vasco of the Franciscan Foundation for the Holy Land. An official has criticized the awarding of the Nobel Prize for Medicine to the pioneer of in vitro fertilization, Dr. Robert Edwards. Bishop Ignacio de Paula, president of the Pontifical Academy for Life, said the Nobel Award raised a great number of ethical questions. At the same time, he conceded that Dr. Edwards' research had led to a new chapter in the field of human reproduction, notably the birth in 1978 of Louise Brown, the world's first baby born through in vitro fertilization. Dr. Helen Watt is the chief research officer at a leading Catholic bioethics institution in Britain, the Anscombe Centre in Oxford. She told me why she disagreed with the choice of Dr. Edwards as the Nobel Laureate for Medicine this year.
Robert Edwards is the last person who should get an award of this kind. He is personally responsible for embryo experimentation, that is experimentation on very young human beings, the birth of Louise Brown was only achieved via experimentation on embryos leading up to it. And of course, many, many embryos have been killed in experiments since that time.
Nonetheless, there are people that would say that his work has brought, as the Nobel Medicine Prize Committee said, joy to infertile people all over the world. How do you try to get across the message to people that they should not buy up to this treatment? How should you get the message across to Catholics?
Of course, every child's birth is a wonderful thing. Every child is something very precious, however that child was conceived. But for that very reason, the conception of a child should reflect the dignity of that child. It's so momentous, conceiving a new human being, that it has to be done in the right way. And it's completely wrong to manufacture a child as if that child were an object, a product, and then to throw away substandard embryos because they are thought to be substandard products. This is not how we should be conceiving a new human life.
Do you nonetheless find that it's sometimes difficult, though, to persuade some Catholics that IVF treatment is contrary to church teaching? And because, of course, infertility is a big problem. It affects apparently more than 10% of all couples worldwide.
Infertility is a great grief for very many people, and it's quite difficult sometimes for couples to accept that IVF is morally wrong. Now, for many couples, there will be alternatives they can try, some of them quite successful. One example would be NAPRO technology, which is being offered in various places around the world. But I think the couple must above all take the attitude that having a child is something you have to do right, and there are certain things you must not do, even to achieve something as wonderful as the birth of a baby.
And looking at the question of in vitro fertilisation in general, as we know, it started in 1978, but overall, a woman who undergoes in vitro fertilisation, what chance does she have of having a baby at the end of it? What are the figures there?
Again, it depends on the country and the clinic. Figures you often hear are around the 30% mark for live births per IVF cycle. But given that several embryos are created in the same cycle, the likelihood of any individual embryo being given a chance of going to term and then going to term is much below that. They're not even given a chance. They're discarded immediately because they're thought to be abnormal, or they're frozen and then not used, as the term is, by the parents.
One of the ethical questions that's also been raised by IVF treatment is, in fact, that it's led to a worldwide market in human embryos, hasn't it? Is money somehow tied up with all this?
Money is very much tied up with IVF, and indeed in America, college girls can sell their eggs for large amounts of money on the grounds that these are superior eggs of women with above average IQ and so forth. This is very much a market. We're seeing surrogate mothers in India being used. We're seeing embryos shipped in from other countries for those surrogates to gestate them. This is no way of treating the process of conceiving a new life and the process of nurturing a new life, which should be something very personal, very special, something very much about the marriage of a couple and the act of natural intercourse which reflects that marriage.
I was speaking to Dr. Helen Watt of the Anscombe Bioethics Centre in Oxford.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.